It was the biggest one-day point drop in the history of the Dow. So what is going on? A healthy correction in an overheated market or something else? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the studios at WYPR in Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. Okay, deep breath, everybody. When it was all said and done, the Dow lost more than 1,100 points today, the largest same-day point drop on record. The final percentage drop, 4.6%. We've got Marketplace's Sabri Benishour with us live to give us some context. Hi, Sabri.
Hi, Amy.
So what is going on? Help us out.
Well, yeah, it's been wild, really just wild. It was, as you mentioned, the largest intraday drop in terms of points in history, 6.26%. The last time we had that was the flash crash in 2010. Now, we've recovered some, so we didn't close down that far. But it was a wild ride. I talked to Chris Lowe. He's head of FTN Financial. He was just off the trading floor earlier this afternoon. This is what he saw at the time.
We were down about 700 points, and in the space of about 10 minutes, we dropped another 850 or so, at which point the market came roaring back, and now we're down 1,000 again.
So volatility, any explanation as to why this is happening now? I mean, we saw a little bit of a drop Friday, but this is another story entirely.
It is. To be perfectly honest, Amy, a lot of the analysts I talk to don't know. I mean, they could not say, you know, on the surface, there's no crisis. There's no shattering new economic data. There's no change in forecasts to explain why this happened today. But a couple of people I talked to did offer one idea. John Lonsky is with Moody's Analytics.
There is one possibility, and it was basically algorithms at work, equity buy and sell programs that sensed that this was a good time to take profits and get out of the market.
So basically, a whole lot of trading robots happened to decide that this was a good time to get out of the market. And, you know, that does make sense, because if you are an investor, even if you've just been paying attention to the stock market over the past year, you've probably asked yourself, or maybe it's come up in casual conversation, you know, gee, how long can this go on for? When should I get out? Well, if you asked your robot to figure that out for you, it looks like all the robots may have decided that the answer to that question was just after 3 p.m. Eastern today.
But markets have been headed down for several days since last week. I mean, is this connected to something more fundamental?
Well, I don't think necessarily, because this shattering fall we had this afternoon, you know, from which, again, there has been some mild recovery, but we're still down, you know, 4% and some. That is distinct from the drop we saw on Friday. The background to all of this is that stock markets are worried about several things. They're worried about inflation. We got strong wage growth numbers last week suggesting inflation. They are worried about bond yields. We saw bond yields rise very steeply last week. Stocks don't look as bright when bonds are shining. Markets are worried about increased government debt. The government's going to borrow twice as much this year as next year. All of those things are in line with a general dropping in the stock market. And on top of that, people have been waiting for a correction sometime. But corrections typically take a month to work themselves out. This took like 10 minutes. So I do think today was something different.
And real quick, before I let you go, how widely do you suppose this will be felt? I mean, how serious is this really?
Well, 1,500 points in a day, that is a record for the Dow to fall that sharply in one day. But at the same time, the Dow has also never been this high to begin with. So if you look percentage-wise, the Dow closed down 4.6% at the end of the day. That is terrible, but it has happened before. Last time was in 2011. We have had a lot of money pour into the market in the past couple of months, $102 billion in January. That was a record. So there was clearly a lot of optimism running up towards the end of the year. And I think to the extent that reflected a lot of optimism, we can now clearly say that that optimism is turned, has gone sour, and is going to be replaced by caution. I would say that all the fundamentals of the economy, those are still strong. No one is saying, like, get out of the stock market entirely right now.
All right, Marketplace's Sabri Benishour. We'll look at some of the companies in the red column today when we do the numbers. Jerome Powell was sworn in today as the new chairman of the Federal Reserve, but it's his predecessor, Janet Yellen, and one of her last actions as Fed chair that's making waves in the banking industry today. Bank stocks saw some of the biggest drops on Wall Street, including Wells Fargo, which lost more than 9%. Late Friday, the Fed slapped new sanctions on the bank. It's the latest fallout from a series of scandals at Wells Fargo involving millions of fake customer accounts. The agreement with the Fed blocks the bank from growing any larger until the Fed is satisfied with its governance reforms. Wells also agreed to replace four of its board members. Renee Merle has been following the story for The Washington Post. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
This is a reminder that the Federal Reserve does a lot more than set monetary policy. Talk about its role as a bank regulator.
It's actually one of the most important banking regulators, even though people don't think about them in those terms. What the Federal Reserve does is help the banks set their capital requirements, their liquidity requirements. They actually play a pretty important role in regulating banks.
And this has been called Janet Yellen's mic drop. It happened literally in the final hours of her term. Is there any sign that Trump's appointee to take her place, Jerome Powell, who was sworn in today, would approach this role any differently?
Actually, he was one of the three Fed governors who approved this deal with Wells Fargo. So it seems that he would stay on the same path as Janet Yellen on these issues.
What do you think it tells us about the different roles that different federal agencies play in regulating banks? I mean, at the same time, the Trump administration has moved to rein in the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, stripping it of some of its enforcement powers. Is regulation going to look different going forward?
I would say for sure. The way that the Trump administration is going about reining in the CFPB, we actually expect some of that to continue with the Federal Reserve as well, that they're going to take another look at some of the rules and regulations that were put in after the financial crisis and look for ways to simplify it or just ease it. This Wells Fargo case, in part, is just a reflection of just how bad things had gotten at Wells Fargo, that the Federal Reserve really couldn't ignore it.
So this is the first time the Fed has placed limits on a bank's assets?
It's the first time in recent memory. There might have been a time, you know, a couple decades ago, but when you talk to people inside the Federal Reserve, it's the first time that they can remember that this has happened.
Meanwhile, Wells Fargo has agreed to replace four of its board members as part of this agreement. What's the motivation there? And do you think that has implications for other financial institutions?
I definitely do. And the implication is that, you know, the usual playbook is that when a bank does something wrong, it'll pay some small fine, a relatively small fine. For example, the Wells Fargo was fined $100 million by the CFPB. But that's really just a small amount of money for an institution as big as Wells Fargo. In this way, by saying that they have to replace four of their board members, is showing that there are going to be consequences to individual people within the company. The board of directors is supposed to act as an independent body that oversees this really big company. And the Federal Reserve is saying that we're going to hold you responsible for doing that.
Renee Merle covers Wall Street and white-collar crime for The Washington Post. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
All this year, Marketplace is looking at how the financial crisis a decade ago and its aftermath changed America. It's a project we call Divided Decade, and we've been asking for your stories about how the crisis changed you. Here's listener Tara Gilchrist from South Bend, Indiana.
I do feel somewhat responsible with the onset of the mortgage crisis. In 2007, I had this great job as an underwriter at a subprime mortgage lender. At the time, our guidelines, you could have a debt ratio of up to 55%. And when you think of that, that's over half of your monthly income going just to pay for your housing. You know, thinking back, that's pretty crazy. But I believed we were really helping people achieve home ownership that would not have been able to otherwise. we were able to help them with the American dream. It does still keep me up at night, the mortgage crisis. And I go through it and I think about, I was young in the industry, how would I have known any better? But really, the signs were there. I don't want to give myself a pass, but I also don't want to have it ruin my life. I was the sole income provider for my children, and I didn't want to lose my job. Because I do feel some level of responsibility, I feel like I also should accept responsibility for helping people where they are right now. My career has evolved to this point where I am now a corporate recruiter, and I love it. I want to make sure that I am helping other people in their careers. For me personally, I'm glad that it happened because I feel like I'm a better person, more aware of people and the world around me, and I feel empowered to make a difference. And even if it's in a small way, it should be a positive way.
Tara Gilchrist shared her story at our website, marketplace.org/divided decade. You can see photos on Instagram at marketplaceapm. And you can let us know how the financial crisis changed you with the hashtag #HowWeChanged. It's all part of our year-long series, Divided Decade. Not all sports victories are created equal. Had Tom Brady and his Patriots won the Super Bowl yesterday, yes, there would be fewer people moping at work today in New England. But it would have been the team's sixth win. Instead, the Eagles eked out their very first Super Bowl championship. And there's an economic theory that helps explain why this first win might be more valuable for Philadelphia. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains.
Little bit of a warning here. We're going to talk about a really interesting idea with a really not that interesting name.
Diminishing marginal utility.
God, economists really need to get better at naming stuff. Victor Matheson is a sports economist at the College of the Holy Cross in Massachusetts, though he's actually a Broncos fan.
Not crying this morning.
Matheson says there are diminishing returns to winning for sports teams and their fans.
It doesn't mean that you don't keep liking to win those Super Bowls, but each additional Super Bowl gets you just a little bit less happiness than the one before.
So true, Patriots fans are always pretty passionate, but...
Probably wouldn't see people in New England go out and buy that sixth NFL Super Bowl championship sweatshirt in the same way that you see the Phillies folks going.
That might also be why StubHub, the ticket reseller, saw a bit more demand for Super Bowl tickets from Pennsylvania than from Massachusetts. The Pats have been in 8 Super Bowls since 2001.
Eagles fans have been waiting their lifetime for this.
Raymond Sauer, a professor of economics at Clemson University, says it's actually not that healthy for the Patriots or for the league if a single team wins all the time.
You need your competitors to thrive for the league to be successful. So for the Yankees to be successful, they need the Red Sox.
He says with the Pats, the NFL was dangerously close to the kind of super dominance that turns fans off and makes them tune out. So just maybe it was lucky the Eagles swooped in. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Footprint of agriculture has grown a good deal beyond what the water can cover.
How to run one of the world's largest farming operations when water runs scarce. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 1,175 points, or 4.6% to close at 24,345. The NASDAQ down 2. It fell 273 points, 3.75% to finish at 69.67. And the S&P 500 shed 113 points, 4.1% to end at 26.48. Banking was one of the sectors taking a hit on today's market slide. Goldman Sachs gave back 4.2%. Citigroup down 4.8%. Bank of America shed 5.2%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.70%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. People in drought-stricken Cape Town, South Africa, got a little bit of good news today. The city is still expected to run out of water this year. But the day that happens has been pushed back from April 16th to May 11th because of falling agricultural water use. City authorities have opened a disaster operations center to deal with the task of shutting down the city's water supply. If the taps are turned off on so-called day zero, it will mean Cape Town becomes the first major city in the world to run dry. The BBC's Andrew Harding reports.
It's almost like a game here in Cape Town. Who can save the most water?
When we wash our lettuce, for example, we'll wash it in a sink.
The hotel chefs are playing it.
And then you reuse that water to mop the floors.
Hello! Yeah.
The comedians are riffing on it.
You know, Neighbourhood Watch?
No.
Well, we have Neighbourhood Wash. That's where the neighbour has come to you to wash.
And the internet is full of people offering tips. And, of course, filming themselves in the shower.
There you go. 3 litres of water is all you need.
The enthusiasm is impressive, and it's helped Cape Town to reduce its water consumption by nearly half. But it's not enough. This wealthy, sophisticated city is still on course to run dry.
Cape Town is currently facing its worst drought ever. The city would like to thank each and every resident who has been reusing greywater and doing everything they can to save the water we have left. But not enough residents are actively saving.
3 years of unprecedented and unexpected drought have emptied the reservoirs and pushed Cape Town close to calamity.
The crisis is now. We're running out of water. We're looking at that glass. It's no longer half full. It's now half empty.
Climate scientist Peter Johnson blames global warming and offers few consolations.
Well, you see, the day zero is now real. There's a good chance that we're not going to get significant rains in the next 2 months. There really is. So it's a real situation. The dams, you can go and look at them. They are very, very low. So it is in your face right now. And although some people don't take it seriously, they are still going to face the same consequences as everybody else.
Oh, I think it's going to get much worse. So it's best if we start piling up water now already.
A bit apprehensive, yeah. It's a bit scary, actually.
You know, if everybody do their bit, it will be fine.
But it seems like a lot of people aren't doing what's right.
You always get that. You'll always get that.
Councillor Xanthia Lindberg is leading the city's preparations.
If people don't have water, if they're queuing, if there's panic, you couldn't have a situation here where you need a state of emergency.
Well, these are all of the very real risks and realities that we might have to face. This is why our disaster risk plan has brought on board the South African police force as well as the army so that we can attempt to maintain law and order as much as possible.
In the meantime, the authorities are drilling into underground aquifers, building desalination plants to convert seawater, and battling with the national government for more funding. But the expectation is that droughts and restrictions will be the new normal here. And British tourists like Miriam Pollock are taking it in their stride.
So it was easy just to cut down how you can just fill half a bucket and wash yourself in the shower. How you don't leave the tap running when you're cleaning your teeth. Now, when you go home, you will not take your water so much for granted. I certainly won't, and I see what's happened here.
The BBC's Andrew Harding in Cape Town, South Africa. And sticking with the topic of water and not enough of it, if you've ever had wonderful pistachios, palm pomegranate juice, or halo mandarin oranges, then you've had produce grown on one of the largest farms in the world, in a farming region that has become one of the most water-starved. The wonderful company, owned and operated by husband and wife Stuart and Linda Resnick, operates a massive farm in central California, a farm that, despite record droughts in that state, has somehow increased its yield. Mark Arax spent time with Stuart Resnick and wrote about it in California Sunday Magazine. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
There's a stunning aerial photo in the magazine that shows these green trees surrounded basically by dust. In fact, the piece is called A Kingdom from Dust. It's a pretty dry place, right?
Yeah, this is the southern end of the San Joaquin Valley, and it's an area that doesn't have groundwater. So it's there completely because of the State Water Project, water that has shipped, you know, hundreds of miles from the north of California where there are these abundant rivers. The problem is this last drought lasted 5 years, so the state couldn't deliver. In 1 year, it couldn't deliver any of it. So the question before me was, how are these guys farming? And in fact, these guys were able to squeeze and buy water in the open market and do a few other things to keep their crops going. And they were in the midst of drought. They were actually harvesting record crops. So it was...
Yeah, so you set out with this question, how was he defying nature? And one of the things he was doing was sort of an off-the-books irrigation deal?
So because there's no groundwater out in Lost Hills... They came up with this idea of pumping groundwater from 40, 50 miles away. This water basically came from a land owned by someone who's also a near billionaire, a guy named John Vidovich. And Vidovich ended up pumping water, an extraordinary amount of water, out of the ground. In an area where they're pumping so much water out of the ground, the land is sinking. And he was able to use canals and pumping stations to then get that water in this pipeline that very secretly was connected to irrigation ditches in Lost Hills. And so that water was feeding Resnick pistachios and almonds and keeping them alive in the worst of the drought.
So we should talk about the labor that makes this all possible. A lot of it is undocumented. And there are these sort of company towns that you describe that are maybe even more sort of dedicated to the company than most.
This place called Lost Hills, it is kind of a modern day company town, not unlike Hershey, Pennsylvania. And the Resnicks run the place. That's where this story gets conflicted and very complicated, because in the last 5 to 8 years, they have committed millions and millions of dollars to making this place better, educating the children, helping the workers deal with obesity and things like that. So it's a really extraordinary kind of development that's never happened in agriculture in California before, really, to raise the living of your workers.
How sustainable is this operation, given, you know, that California only recently came out of a long drought and may actually be headed there again soon? What happens to Wonderful?
That is the question that you know, I'm dealing with in this magazine piece. And the footprint of agriculture has grown a good deal beyond what the water can cover. The abundance of that water in good years has created this overreach of agriculture. And then what happens in drought is there's this desperation to keep it going, and then they pump more groundwater. Well, ultimately, you're going to dry up that aquifer under the earth, and that's what's happening now. And so the question of sustainability is front and center here now in California. How much bigger can agriculture get? In fact, it should be getting smaller, more sustainable. And that's what you're seeing play out on the land right now.
And, of course, that could have serious implications for these workers. What happens to them if Wonderful downsizes?
They lose their livelihood. Already mechanization is changing, you know, the labor situation. The citrus is still hand-picked, but all the nuts are machine-picked, and that's idled workers as well. So we're seeing a shift now. And then to have nature imposing its will on the situation.
Mark Arax is a journalist and author who wrote a piece about the Resnicks and their wonderful company for California Sunday Magazine. It's really a stunning piece of writing. Mark, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
The This final note, did you notice any unequal snacking at your Super Bowl party last night? Because apparently women don't like to crunch our chips loudly in public or lick our fingers. That's according to PepsiCo's female CEO, Indra Nooyi. She told Freakonomics Radio that the company is preparing to launch a line of women-friendly snacks like low-crunch chips with less stuff that sticks to your fingers. Okay. That's it. We gotta go. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 1,175 points, 4.6%. You heard that right. The NASDAQ fell 273 points, 3.75%, and the S&P 500 shed 113 points, 4.1%. And you can follow the market open tomorrow on Morning Report. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. Our special projects desk includes Tommy Andres and Haley Hirschman. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. And I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. I will see you tomorrow. This is APM.